The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the esophagus is presented by Dr. Lindsay Morehart.
So a lot of my lecture has questions kind of spread throughout the lecture. So if you want to answer them, you are welcome to, but we'll kind of go through. I am a fast talker, so if you need me to slow down, just let me know, or again, ask me afterwards. So we'll get you through this, hopefully not too painful. So the first case is a 32-year-old male. He presents with a burning sensation in the chest following most large meals for about the last 2 to 3 months. He denies any dysphagia, weight change, or bleeding. Which of the following has the highest sensitivity for the initial diagnosis of GERD with typical symptoms? So we have a barium swallow, empiric omeprazole, wireless pH monitoring, or an EGD. So this is going to be B, a PPI inhibitor test. Basically, put them on empiric omeprazole. Sensitivity is about 78%, specificity 54%. A barium swallow isn't really great for diagnosing GERD. A lot of times you'll see acid reflux on these when people don't complain of acid reflux. pH testing, it does have a specific role, but it's more in complicated cases or before surgeries, not in basic reflux. And then EGD is pretty low sensitivity. It's good in identifying erosive esophagitis, but you're only going to see that in about 50 to 60% of patients. So next we have a 62-year-old male. He presents with reflux predominant dyspepsia. He doesn't complain of any alarm symptoms. What would you do next in this case? So do you want to do an EGD? Do you want to test him for H. pylori? Do you want to prescribe a PPI like in our last patient? Or should we do lifestyle modifications? So this one's a little bit different. So he's a 62-year-old guy. Actually, it's not necessary to do an EGD in most patients with GERDs initially, but if you have alarm symptoms, you definitely do want to do an EGD. So you're looking for dysphagia, hematemesis, anemia, weight loss, maybe early satiety. About 50% of patients with typical GERD symptoms will have a normal endoscopy. In this guy, we choose endoscopy because of his age, and we'll kind of go into that. It identifies complications of GERD, so you're looking at ulcers, Barrett's esophagus, stricture, adenocarcinoma. An upper GI x-ray really isn't going to give us too much information other than stricture, large hiatal hernias, but if someone's not complaining of dysphagia, you may not see much on there. It's only about 20% sensitive for GERD. And again, the pH monitoring, you're looking at atypical symptoms, frequent atypical chest pain, refractory symptoms, and a pre-op confirmation of GERD. So here again, EGD was the correct choice because according to the guidelines, if you look at them, they say really if you're over 55 or you have alarm symptoms, so you're having an unintended weight loss, dysphagia, GI bleeding, iron deficiency, abnormal physical exam, mass in the abdomen. Sometimes you really have to talk to these people about dysphagia. They kind of ignore it. They'll say, oh yeah, every once in a while my food gets stuck. Well, every once in a while is every day. They're having bread, chicken, et cetera, and then I'm in at 2:30 in the morning pulling it out. So let's work on getting that fixed beforehand. All right, so what is the single most informative study in patients with medically refractory GERD? We have an EGD, pH monitor, barium swallow, or CT scan of the chest. So pH monitoring, this can document abnormal acid exposure in an EGD negative patient. So you might go in, you might do an EGD on someone. It doesn't look that abnormal, but they're just still complaining of pretty severe symptoms. You can use this after anti-reflux surgery to document abnormal reflux. So normal or equivocal EGD findings and reflux symptoms. or refractory to PPI therapy. It was maybe when you'd want to get pH monitoring to see if, are they actually having acid reflux? Is it non-acid reflux? Is it none of the above and it's just dyspepsia? So you can use it to detect reflux in chest pain patients after they've done a four-week trial of PPI and definitely after they've had a cardiac evaluation. That's another one. People will complain of heartburn, but maybe it's cardiac in nature, like a chest pain, and we always like to make sure that they've been evaluated as far as that before we're doing anything further. So if there's a suspected ENT type GERD, so laryngitis, pharyngitis, cough, cough's a big one we get asked about, after symptoms have failed to respond to a four-week trial of PPI. And then you can document concomitant reflux in an adult onset asthmatic. So we have a 52-year-old female who's had GERD for the past 10 years. She's requiring standard PPI daily. She's been inquiring about lifestyle modifications. Which of the following changes have been shown to improve GERD? Smoking cessation, discontinuation of carbonated beverages, elevation of the head of the bed, or my least favorite, avoiding chocolate consumption. So GERD and lifestyle, really of that list, only elevation of the head of the bed, but weight loss, avoiding eating 3 hours before bed have been shown to improve GERD. I usually tell my patients 4 hours before bed because then they'll avoid it 2 hours before bed. The others either have no studies to support their role in clinical practice or studies haven't really shown improvement in GERD. So there's the answer there. Okay, so factors that you're going to see that are associated with severe esophagitis. So this is a big one that we can't really see on an EGD, but you have a low lower esophageal sphincter pressure. And that's transient. That's one of the biggest things that we'll see. And just on and off, that will relax, and that's when people are getting acid reflux. You can see esophageal motor abnormalities that can cause this. Recumbent reflux, this is a bad one, especially for people at nighttime, because they're not necessarily waking up and realizing that they're having acid reflux. And then presence of a hiatal hernia is also important. This is when you see a lot of times like a thin person will come in with bad acid reflux, they have a big hiatal hernia. So you have a 54-year-old male with a long history of GERD symptoms. He underwent an EGD to exclude Barrett's esophagus. He had a 7-centimeter salmon-colored tongue extending from the EG junction. Multiple biopsies of this area were taken, and they revealed intestinal metaplasia with low-grade dysplasia. What should be the next step in this patient's management? So are you going to do RFA, radiofrequency ablation? Do you want to change their treatment to a stronger PPI? Do you want to have an expert GI pathologist review the biopsies? Or should you initiate a more intense surveillance? So anytime that you see somebody with Barrett's esophagus with any type of dysplasia, low or high grade dysplasia, you should be having an expert GI pathologist review the slides. If there's no dysplasia, you do not have to have an expert GI pathologist. So when you're looking at Barrett's esophagus, this is a big thing that we are seeing quite a bit more of now. Columnar epithelium replaces the stratified squamous epithelium in the esophagus. This comes from years of acid reflux into the esophagus. You see it associated with reflux symptoms, age greater than 50, more frequently in the male sex, Caucasian race, central obesity, and tobacco use. These patients require surveillance endoscopy due to their increased risk of adenocarcinoma. So the risk of progression starts for non-dysplastic Barrett's at about 0.02% annually. It seems minimal, but it is important. So this is a picture of Barrett's esophagus. That's a pretty long segment. You can see, let's see, does that show up there? No, it doesn't. Okay. So really, the GE junction's down here, and it should be this nice color all the way down to that area. So this whole area is Barrett's esophagus. So when you look at the ACG guidelines, you should screen for Barrett's esophagus in patients who have multiple risk factors. So if someone just starts having acid reflux, they're less than 50 years old, they don't need a screening like we do for colonoscopies for Barrett's esophagus. So you're looking for more in the male patients, greater than 50 years old, Caucasian race, chronic GERD. So we want them to have GERD for greater than 5 years. Central obesity, current or past history of smoking, and then obviously a confirmed history of Barrett's esophagus or esophageal cancer. So the ACG is actually against screening the general population for GERD. So patients with Barrett's, you need to give them therapy if they have an acute esophagitis. So when someone comes in, they have ulcers or a bad esophagitis, we're putting them on PPI therapy and repeating an EGD in about 8 weeks or so to look to see that that inflammation's healed. Then you can biopsy, because sometimes with the inflammation, you can't necessarily see the Barrett's esophagus. And again, the dysplasia should be confirmed by a second expert GI pathologist. So if you don't have any dysplasia, you just have basic Barrett's esophagus, so the intestinal metaplasia, you can do a surveillance endoscopy. They say 3 to 5 years, I usually do 3 years. Low-grade dysplasia, these people now, endoscopic therapy, so RFA versus 12-month surveillance. If they have high-grade dysplasia and the absence of eradication therapy, so maybe someone isn't a great candidate for this, repeat multiple endoscopies, then you should do surveillance every 3 months. So here we have a 31-year-old female. She presents with 6 months of dysphagia, recurrent chest pain. She has difficulty swallowing after every meal. Dysphagia has progressed to solids and liquids. So this is kind of a clue there with the solids and liquids. She has daily heartburn. She's lost about 5 pounds in the last 6 months. When you do an EGD on her, it looks pretty normal. So the next step here was manometry. Manometry shows that there's basically no peristalsis in the esophagus. She has a high lower esophageal sphincter pressure slash elevated IRP. And there's no relaxation with the swallows. What's the most likely diagnosis here? So does she have a stricture from maybe bad acid reflux over time? Is there nutcracker esophagus here? Does she have just kind of a basic nonspecific motility disorder? Or are we dealing with achalasia? So achalasia. This is pretty classic finding for achalasia. There's three subtypes, but probably you guys just need to know for the test basically that this is a presentation with that high LES pressure, IRP, no motility in the esophagus. And the EGD didn't show malignancy, so that's another thing you need to make sure about, that you don't have something called pseudoachalasia. So is there a mass wrapping around extrinsically around the GE junction? So this is a pretty rare disease. It comes from the loss of the ganglion cells within the myenteric plexus. They're not certain of the cause, but they do think that there's increasing evidence recently to suggest that there may be some type of an autoimmune process kind of attributed to a latent infection with herpes simplex 1 combined with a genetic susceptibility. But the main thing that you'll probably hear people ask about is the loss of the ganglion cells within the myenteric plexus. So you're going to have someone that comes in with dysphagia. Most all patients will complain of that. It's been present for a number of years. And these patients learn adaptive behaviors. You'll see them swallowing air. Sometimes they have all the foam from the secretions in their esophagus, and you'll see them spitting it out. They eat very slowly. They lose weight because of this. They'll get regurgitation, chest pain. Weight loss, again, is a big thing. And heartburn, because your esophagus gets dilated. You have this esophageal stretch. You get this bacterial fermentation, retained food in there. It's pretty uncomfortable. These people are also at risk for aspiration as it gets pretty severe. Food sits in their esophagus. They go to bed, lay down. They don't know they have it. So here's the classic board's picture, bird's beak esophagus. Other things that you can think about when you see a patient that complains of this in the differential, you could say, you know, a diffuse esophageal spasm. Again, pretty rare. Chagas, pretty rare. But they like to test for the rare things on boards, I suppose. So, diffuse esophageal spasm, again, rare. About 3 to 10% of non-cardiac chest pain or unexplained dysphagia is related to this. I have a friend who's a cardiologist who says he tells everybody that their chest pain is related to their esophagus, and I fortunately don't work in the same town as them. Some patients improve spontaneously. You'll see these simultaneous waves of contraction through the esophagus. The treatment that you're going to hear about is diltiazem. Probably most important, though, is to treat people for GERD, because a lot of this can relate to GERD. So make sure that they're maxed out on their treatment for acid reflux, and then that's when you can change to diltiazem if that's not working. So here we have probably one of the reasons I get called in pretty frequently at night. 24-year-old male being evaluated for solid food dysphagia for the past 3 years. He describes an intermittent sticking of primarily meat and bread in the substernal region. It usually resolves with water. EGD and biopsies performed, and these biopsies show a high level of eosinophils. So the most appropriate next step in this patient's care would be allergy skin testing, a 4-week trial of steroid inhaler, 24-hour pH monitor, 8-week trial of omeprazole, 40 milligrams twice daily, or manometry. So when you see this patient, you're thinking, do they have reflux esophagitis? Is there a stricture or a web, or is this eosinophilic esophagitis? So this is a pretty typical presentation for eosinophilic esophagitis, or EOE for short. They're frequently young, or they present to you at an older age, but they've had this since they were young. They get these recurrent food impactions, but they're able to, you know, chew their food smaller or swallow it down with water, and they don't really necessarily have acid reflux. So you're going to look at their history to suggest that they maybe have EOE. One of the big things that I see is a history of asthma, or maybe a family history of asthma. Manometry doesn't necessarily show us an answer in this. You need to do an EGD with the biopsies, and we biopsy in the proximal and distal esophagus. So you see that kind of, let's see here, ringed appearance, the esophagus, or they say sometimes they'll call it trachealization. That's what you're going to see in EOE. So you need to have, this is a good board question, the presence of 15 to 20 or more eosinophils per high-powered field. And that's going to, and you need to have it from the distal and proximal esophagus. I don't know if they'll get that specific, but because you can have eosinophils in the distal esophagus just from acid reflux, but when you can see that it's in the proximal esophagus, you can tell that that's from EOE. So again, you need to exclude GERD. And in these people, you start first with a trial of PPI. So is this PPI responsive EOE? So you do that for 2 months, and about 75% of the time, you're going to have clinical remission in these patients. You bring them back and you rebiopsy to make sure that those eosinophils are gone. If they're not, then you move on to the next things. You can do an elimination diet. This is pretty hard for people. There's the 6 most common foods. They suggest maybe now that you can start with wheat, eggs, milk, and soy, but otherwise you should add in peanuts and seafood as well. And it's usually tree nuts. The next thing you can do is a topical glucocorticoid. So most patients will respond to this, and they don't want to inhale it like an inhaler. They want to actually squirt it in their mouth and then swallow it. Dilation can be effective. These people, when you dilate EOE, their esophagus likes to splay open. You don't really want to go back down and look at it afterwards. The mean duration of response for this is about 8 to 15 months, and the risk of perforation is about 1%. So that first answer for that was 8-week trial of omeprazole. You try that first. So you have a 51-year-old male. He's seen for dysphagia of liquids and solids that occur immediately after swallowing. The patient reports coughing and choking during meals with occasional nasal regurgitation. EGD was pretty normal. You do a manometry and it shows normal peristalsis, so the esophagus is moving, normal lower esophageal sphincter pressure, but you look at the upper esophageal sphincter and this pressure is a little bit low, and the amplitudes in the pharynx and proximal esophagus were abnormally low. What's the most likely diagnosis? Is this scleroderma, lupus, Parkinson's, dermatomyositis, or diabetes? So dermatomyositis affects swallowing involved in the striated muscle. So you can see here the upper esophagus here is the striated muscle. Dermatomyositis and lupus may result in non-specific motor abnormalities. Scleroderma affects the distal 2/3 of the esophagus. These people a lot of time will have reflux. So when you're looking at someone with oral pharyngeal versus esophageal dysphagia, They have a difficulty initiating that swallow associated with coughing or choking or nasal regurgitation. So they're going to take in some food and they're instantly going to start choking or coughing or maybe even just water. So they do have a sensation that the food gets stuck in their esophagus seconds after they initiate a swallow. So abnormalities that affect the striated muscle of the mouth, pharynx, and upper esophageal sphincter are related to the oral pharyngeal dysphagia. So this is kind of the differential for oral pharyngeal. So maybe it's just meds or post-surgical, there's infectious, metabolic. These are pretty rare, but the more common ones you might see are, you know, a CVA, Parkinson's, MS. Is there a tumor there? You know, do they have a cricopharyngeal bar pretty high up? And then sarcoid, and then dermatomyositis. So you can do a barium X-ray. The big one you want to do really is the video fluoroscopic swallow. Upper endoscopy to rule anything out. And then fiber optic nasopharyngeal laryngoscopy or esophageal manometry. So the goals of therapy for this are really to improve food transfer and prevent aspiration. We see a lot of these people that will come in with recurrent pneumonia because they aren't getting their food past their airway. So next we have a 16-year-old. He presents with sudden onset of odynephagia after waking in the morning. She's fairly healthy with a history of exercise-induced asthma and acne. Her only medications are albuterol and doxycycline. What's the most likely cause for this? Schatzky's ring, hiatal hernia, pill esophagitis, or infectious esophagitis? So pill esophagitis, these are kind of the big offenders. She was on doxycycline. A lot of times in the older patients, the alendronate is a big one. Those iron and potassium pills are huge. So these often get stuck and cause irritation in that area. When you're looking at these people often complain of odynephagia, painful swallowing, and or dysphagia. HSV is a big one, CMV in Canada. Here's a picture of HSV. You can see the ulcers there. And Canada is more of kind of like these white plaques. And this can be pretty painful for people. HSV, this is more common in immunocompromised people. All three of those are, but occasionally it's seen in patients who are immunocompetent. The vast majority of these infections are related to HSV type 1. It can result from a reactivation of HSV, which with spread of the virus to the esophageal mucosa by the way of the vagus nerve, or by direct extension from oral pharyngeal infection into the esophagus. So the treatment here, you're going to do antivirals. Acyclomer is probably the biggest one that we end up using. Famvir, Valtrex as well.